The headlines, Turkey protests over Greece deploying dozens of U.S. armored vehicles on non-military islands in the Aegean Sea. Japan's decision to hold a state funeral for the assassinated Prime Minister Shinzo Abe becomes controversial. Also ahead, Edward Snowden is now officially a citizen of Russia, almost a decade after the U.S. stripped the former intelligence officer of his passport. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Ankara has summoned the Greek ambassador over alleged provocations in the Aegean Sea, where the two sides have been at odds over the status of Greek islands. Turkey is angered by Greece for deploying armored vehicles on the two islands of Lesbos and Samos. Ankara says that this is a violation of the international law and is calling on Athens to respect the formally agreed non-military status of the area. The Turkish government has also sent a protest note to the U.S. That is after Ankara shared recorded aerial images showing ships loaded with U.S.-made military equipment docking at the island. In response, Greece has rejected Turkish accusations as unfounded. The two nations are at odds over a slew of issues, including commercial rights in the Aegean Sea and territorial waters in the Mediterranean. Turkey-Greece tensions continue. Now, as tensions between Turkey and Greece continue, we have with us Karel Velichek, a political analyst. I'm sorry if I've mispronounced your name, sir. U.S. footsteps can be traced wherever there is an ongoing tension between states, from Ukraine and Russia to China and Taiwan to the two Koreas, and now Turkey and Greece. Why is that?
Well, it is because we have a declining Western system, which is both bankrupt financially and which is increasingly oriented towards war confrontation with the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is organizing to try to survive with payment systems outside of the IMF and outside of the dollar zone. And Turkey, which is a bridge between the East and the West, is both a member of NATO, but on the other side, it is increasingly getting closer to the BRICS and to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So the problem here is, of course, the Greek-Turkish tensions are very old, but the problem is that the global security order of the last 20 years has been breaking down, opening a Pandora box where all these other new, these frozen conflicts are being reunited on different local levels.
Thank you very much, sir. That was political analyst Karel Vershkin from Paris. Moving on, Japan is holding a state funeral for the assassinated former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, but the government is receiving a backlash with many people opposing the ceremony. Hundreds have gathered near the venue of the event in the capital of Tokyo to protest. Over the past weeks, Japan has witnessed growing public opposition to the ceremony. Thousands of people have signed a petition against the move over its cost, but that is not the only source of their anger. There have been a number of revelations about links between the former prime minister's political party and a controversial religious group known as the Unification Church. Abe was shot dead on the 8th of July when he was attending a campaign rally in the city of Nara. He was the longest-serving prime minister in Japan. Political commentator Ryan Dawson sheds more light on some of the reasons why a segment of the Japanese population is opposed to holding a state funeral for Abe.
Yeah, well, one, it's usually reserved for emperors. It is costing $12 million. But I don't think that's the sincere reason government will spend $12 million in a day anyway. It's they don't like Shinzo Abe, and they're looking for an excuse, a more acceptable pretext to say we don't want a state funeral. The LDP should have paid for his funeral. His party should have paid, not the government. His party's in charge of the government with Kishida, but usually in the past, if there was any other prominent figure, including other prime ministers, their party would pay for their funeral. You don't make it a state funeral. And so they are elevating him and saying this is for his legacy, but decided by whom? Some people really did not like Abenomics, did not like his policies, thought he was too right-wing, too militant, and then others obviously disagree. But it should have been the party that paid for it. It shouldn't cost even, you know, $12 million is a hefty sum, but I think they're more or less motivated by not liking his policies, and then it was uncovered after his assassination that really brought light to this, that he may have had ties to the Unification Church in South Korea, which is why Tetsuya shot him.
Meanwhile, tensions are sprawling in the Korean Peninsula as the South and the U.S. begin joint war games. North Korea is now warning of war.
The United States is now planning, even at this moment, to conduct joint military exercises, which arouses serious concerns in the surroundings of the Korean Peninsula. Obviously, this is an extremely dangerous act of igniting the fuse to drive the situation on the Korean Peninsula to the brink of war.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, Kim also criticized the UN Security Council for imposing sanctions on North Korea over its nuclear program. He said that the UNSC punishes Pyongyang for bolstering its defense capabilities, but remains silent on the reckless U.S. arms buildup and war crimes. The U.S. has stationed nearly 30,000 troops in South Korea. Its joint naval drills on South Korea's east coast are the first in 5 years and come a day after Pyongyang conducted another ballistic missile launch. North Korea sees such drills as a preparation for an invasion. Earlier this month, the North revised its nuclear weapons law, allowing it to carry out a first strike and vowing never to give up its nukes. Earlier, our correspondent Frank Smith gave us a picture of the situation on the Korean Peninsula, saying the new policies adopted by the North and the South will likely further raise their tensions.
Well, looking at the shift in their law in terms of institutionalizing the potential use of nuclear weapons by North Korea, we need to recognize that that's conditioned upon an attack. If North Korea is attacked, now it says it will respond with nuclear weapons. That also comes in the wake of a shift in South Korea's sort of military posture and a request by the new South Korean president, a new hardline president here, Yoon Suk-yeol, for the military here in South Korea to develop the capability of striking the North Korean leadership directly in the case of some type of conflict. So we see a shift then in North Korea's nuclear response policy in terms of delegating that to field commanders in the case that North Korea is attacked. So again, this kind of raises the tension on the Korean Peninsula, the sort of time period for warning as a conflict might escalate, and the likelihood of an error taking place in terms of forces perhaps anticipating an attack that might not have been taking place, or misreading the military exercises or maneuvers of the other side. It is kind of a dangerous road that the forces of South Korea, the United States, as well as North Korea are headed toward, that again opens up the potential for risk of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
Our Russia's president has granted citizenship to American whistleblower Edward Snowden amid heightened tensions with the U.S. over the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin says President Putin approved citizenship for the former U.S. intelligence contractor after he filed a relevant request. Snowden has been living in Russia for the past 9 years. He was given asylum in 2013 after Washington revoked his American passport for exposing secret files related to the U.S. National Security Agency. The documents revealed vast domestic and international surveillance operations by the NSA. He is now facing charges of espionage and theft of government property in the U.S., which could put him in prison for decades. State Department spokesman Ned Price said on Monday that Snowden should return to the U.S. to face justice. Moving on, Hungary criticizes the European Union for its massive sanctions on Russia, saying the bloc's punitive measures have backfired and caused great damage to the continent. Addressing Parliament, Prime Minister Viktor Orban called anti-Russia sanctions a source of economic troubles and soaring energy prices in Europe. Orban also warned of a prolonged war in neighboring Ukraine and said Budapest needs EU funds for investments in the energy sector. The Prime Minister stressed that if Brussels fails to deliver the funds, Hungary will get them from other sources. Moscow has halted gas deliveries to Europe, citing technical issues caused by Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine. European officials blame Russia for using energy as a weapon. UK's pound sterling has slumped to a record low against the dollar in the wake of the government's last week announcement of biggest tax cuts in 50 years. Our correspondent, Said Puraza, reports.
The British pound takes a pounding yet again, only days after the country's finance minister announced the biggest tax-cutting package in decades, all funded by borrowing at a time of high inflation. They termed it a mini-budget, but it was a mega shift in direction. The Chancellor confirmed the government would implement Prime Minister Liz Truss's leadership campaign pledges to reverse the national insurance rise, cancel the corporation tax rise, and a surprise new tax cut for the highest earners.
Take the additional rate of income tax. At 45%, it is currently higher than the headline top rate in G7 countries like the US and Italy. And it is even higher than social democracies like Norway. But I'm not going to cut the additional rate of tax today, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to abolish it altogether.
Ordinary Britons may not think about exchange rates on a daily basis, but a fall in the pound will affect their day-to-day.
Britain imports nearly half of its foodstuffs, and therefore the pound gets weaker, the cost of that, those basic foodstuffs goes up dramatically. And so anything which is coming in will be hitting inflation at a time when you don't want to have that. The only good news part of actually of this would be actually your exports are now better value. The trouble is if the global demand is shrinking, therefore the demand for those exports would also be shrinking.
There are also concerns about a long recession as winter looms with no end in sight to the energy crisis or the war in Ukraine. Online, calls for a general election are gaining traction. And in the Conservative Party itself, rumors about a no-confidence vote in the brand new prime minister.
Some experts say the UK's central bank, the Bank of England, could intervene to halt the pound sliding. Many others are saying the government's decision to borrow its way out of the current situation could end in tears. Said Puraza, London.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warns that it will target the source of any operation against the country, wherever it may be. The IRGC's deputy chief for operations says Iran will never allow the emergence of any threat in near its borders. Brigadier General Abbas Nilafurushan said the recent artillery and drone attacks on the Iraqi Kurdistan region were carried out as part of the same strategic approach. He added that the base struck played by the biggest role in recent riots in Iran. Neil Furushan stressed that the IRGC attacks were legitimate defense and that Iran had previously declared that it would respond to such threats strongly and decisively. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is ready to work with the International Atomic Energy Agency to resolve questions regarding allegations of uranium particles found at three undeclared sites. In an interview with Alam Monitor, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Tehran will work with the IAEA as long as the agency addresses these questions technically and not politically. Tehran has insisted that the dossier at the IAEA must be shut before any agreement to revive the 2015 deal, which the U.S. left in 2018. The top Iranian diplomat said his country is not afraid of having face-to-face talks with the United States to revive the agreement known as the JCPOA, but he added that such talks should be a game-changer in which Iran sees some gains. Iran slams the European Union's double-standard approach to human rights, saying this is demonstrated by the bloc's over-compliance with U.S. policies. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Baghdadi Kani criticized the EU's, quote, defining silence, that is, on U.S. sanctions and the violation of Iranians' rights. He said the EU is in no position to express concern about the situation of human rights in Iran when the bloc even denies medical supplies to Iranian children suffering from painful skin diseases. Baghdadi Kani's remarks came after EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell criticized Iran for what he called disproportionate use of force against protesters. Protests broke out in several Iranian cities over the death of a young woman who died at a hospital a few days after collapsing at a police station. They later morphed the attacks on security officers in acts of vandalism against public property and sanctities. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Time for love. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Life is a jigsaw puzzle of joys and sorrows. If you do not put the parts beside each other, the hidden beauty will not be visible. Every part is important in its own place. Dear listeners, now we will present you glimpses of the life of former Iranian Air Force commander, Martyr Major General Mansour Sattari, and his wife, Ms. Hamideh Piahvar. Stay tuned, please. Ms. Hamideh Piahvar says, I was in the fourth grade of elementary school. We had a large house. We had a tenant who was an Air Force officer. When he came out of the house, I would imagine myself in a wedding dress beside him. He was my paternal cousin. When he came to our house to propose marriage with me, I went to the childish memoirs. Mansour was accepted at the military school and would come to Tehran for Thursdays and Fridays. He used to study a lot. I was 3 years older than him. In 1966, I finished teacher training course and started teaching. He was also accepted at the officers' college. My father was very rigid as he was a technician of tanks in the army. We were 10 children and I was the second one. I taught English language and I was introduced for a high school as I was successful. Over there, I had to teach 7 lessons. One of these lessons was geometry, in which I was poor. I remembered Mansour, so I telephoned him and he told me that he could teach me geometry on weekends. I managed to buy a house with the help of my father. Mansour proposed me marriage when he was at the 3rd year of the college. I was happy with his proposal, but I told him that I was 3 years older. He soothed me and spoke to my father on the issue. My father told me that Mansour is a good man who could be the Air Force commander if I supported him. Ms. Hamide Piyahvar continues, the proposal ceremony was held and we became betrothed officially. Mansour was very handsome in his military clothes. After that, we would sometimes see each other. Mansour was graduated and started his work as an officer. We started our conjugal life, although it was difficult in the first years. But we were happy as we could administer the life through our efforts. I became pregnant in the first year. Mansour loved to have child. We had agreed upon the name of our children. We had decided to take the name of the child from the nature if it was a girl and named it Surena if it was a boy. Surena was an Iranian commander who had victoriously fought Romans during the Ashkanid era. I was happier beside Mansour. We named the first child Shabnam, meaning dew in English. A few months after the birth of Shabnam, Mansour went to the U.S. for radar control course. He was there for 7 months. It was hard, but he came back. When my daughter was 1.5 years, our second child was born. We named him Surena upon Mansour's suggestion. Mansour would do everything for our welfare and comfort. He would translate, he would write articles, and he would draw pictures. The year of the Islamic Revolution was full of events for us. Mansour was engaged in political activities. We had just tasted the victory of the Islamic Revolution, that the war broke out, and Mansour left for the fronts as a soldier. The fervor and conditions of war have prevailed everywhere, and at times we would hear the martyrdom of someone. Whenever I saw the picture of a martyr, I thought it could happen for Mansour too. I would miss him and pray for him. I would never complain to anyone his absence. But sometimes I would lose patience. Every time that he returned from the front, he was thinner. His schemes had promoted the defensive level of the Air Force. Thus, the reconnaissance of Iraqi aircrafts could be done accurately and Iranian forces could target them more easily. Pilots would say, "We feel comfortable when Sattari is sitting behind the radar." Our fourth child was born when Mansour was in the front more than before due to his position. He had devoted himself to the war. Ms. Hamideh Piahvar, the wife of former Iranian Air Force Commander Martyr Mansour Sattari, continues her account on the life of this brave man. In 1986, he became the commander of the Iranian Army Air Force. This caused more concern. He had planned for self-sufficiency and manufacturing of domestic aircrafts. He had founded the College of Flight and Airspace College. Then, he had a heart attack due to overworking. It took long for him to resume his health. But I realized that he had lost his sense of smell. In one of the operations, he had given his mask to an old driver. Gradually, the effects of chemical attack could be seen. His feet were injured. His body was partly warm and partly cold. Once he was supposed to leave for Kish Island for a mission, on January 5, 1995, he got ready to set out. He used to kiss the children before going. On that day, nobody was at home. Only Surena was in his bed. Mansour went in. But when he came out, his eyes were red. He put his head down so that he couldn't see him. This made me shiver, and I forgot to hold the Quran over his head. He said goodbye and left. He was to come at 8:30 p.m., but he did not. I was worried. I called his office. A man said that he would come the day after. I couldn't sleep till 4 a.m. when Shabnam telephoned and said that his fiancée had been taken by the Air Force without any explanation. I was upset and angry. I asked for the reason, but nobody answered. I waited. At 6:30, they called and said that Mansour had been injured while getting out of the aircraft. They said they would come and take me to the hospital. I got ready hurriedly. I got in the car while it was twilight. I asked, "Which hospital should we go?" The driver burst into tears. I asked the reason. He answered with tears that the commander had been martyred.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Ukraine conflict is continuing full steam ahead, and there are nonstop accusations being made between the Russian and the Ukrainian side, but even more so with the American side. The U.S. President Joe Biden issued a stern warning to Russia if Russia would use nuclear weapons. The U.S. stated clearly it is in it for the long haul with the help of its European allies. This edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the prospects of this war turning to a new phase with Ukraine's new missile delivery system to the U.S., to the referendums which will make four regions part of Russia, to the actual threat of a nuclear war. First, our guests for this edition of the Spotlight are Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst from St. Petersburg. Also joining us is Glenn Deason, professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway, who joins us from Oslo. Welcome to you both. So I'll start first with you, Gilbert Doctorow. President Vladimir Zelensky has received, courtesy of the U.S., sophisticated air defense systems, which my question is, what do you see in this capability, which is set to obviously take the war to the level, perhaps, but also the fact that when we take a look at missile defense systems, they're not just used for defensive purposes, are they? They have capabilities for them to be offensive and can target targets with missiles. Isn't that correct?
Well, I can't comment on the last point. I'm not a military expert, but I have been following the war rather closely, and I would like to take the big picture. The big picture is that the delivery of these air defense missiles will have little impact on the course of the war, because this has not been a war where the Russians from the beginning and ever since have sought total air domination, nor have they used their air force extensively in the war. There has been some close support, ground support, flying at low levels, levels at which the American defense systems would be largely irrelevant. Much of the air support the Russians have given to their artillery and infantry in the field has been helicopters, not high-flying jets, which would be exposed to these American defense systems. It's a wrong equipment for the wrong war. Just as the javelins, which were supposed to turn the war in Ukraine's favor by destroying the Russian tank force, were irrelevant to the way the Russians conducted the war. It has been an artillery war, not a tank war.
So why don't you, if you can, Glenn Deason, spell out for us once and for all, again, if you can, what are we looking at when it comes to the military aspect as to who can overcome the other? And what would that even look like when it comes to either a win or a defeat from either side? Because that would then maybe put to rest how this may move forward and what is needed in order for there to be a win from one side or the other. Glenn Deason, go ahead.
It's correctly that this is an artillery war, and Russia has a superiority of artillery. However, it also has a superiority of aviation and other ways of fighting. And for this reason, we see that Russia has been able to exhaust and destroy a lot of Ukrainian troops. The main weakness of the Russian force is the sheer low number of forces, which we saw in the Kharkov region, which makes it hard to control the entire front line. But where Russia concentrates its forces, it can win the civilian. We've seen this incremental conquering of territory and destroying Ukrainian hardware. Now, the main problem they've been missing is enough troops, and this is why they're mobilizing now to get enough of these troops. The main question is, I would argue that Russia would already have defeated Ukraine if it hadn't been for NATO de facto joining the war by sending all its military equipment to Ukraine. Now, that being said, we kind of reached a level now of the escalation where the United States could supply long-range missiles, and which could strike deep within Russian territory, and this would then put the United States more or less directly in a war with Russia. So the United States and NATO is under great pressure to escalate further in order to balance off this new mobilization by Russia, because the one thing they were missing, they seem to be addressing now by mobilizing 300,000 troops.
Okay, well, I guess there, Gilbert Doctorow says that the U.S. will then maybe want to go deep into Russia, but it doesn't have to go that deep because you have referendums on those four regions, of which I'm sure we know what the outcome of that is going to be. Russia has come out and stated that they would defend their own territory. They would defend those regions as if it's their own territory. And this is where then the talk of nuclear use of weapons comes in. But first, what are your thoughts about the referendum, which ends on the 23rd, and which is today, and pretty much everybody knows what those results are going to be?
The referendum is not about what all the media are saying in the West. It is not about the decision being made by the people on the ground in favor of reintegration into Russian homeland. It is about Russian domestic politics and the legal restraints on the executive, which the referendum and the follow-up vote of the Russian parliament to integrate these new territories into Russia give a free hand to Mr. Putin and to his colleagues to use the forces that have been held back and to bring into play in these territories outside the till now borders of the Russian Federation troops and forces which could not be moved legally beyond the Russian frontiers. So it's all about Russia and very little about these territories, because territories voted already in 2014, in effect, to join Russia. The Kremlin didn't recognize that and asked them to restrain themselves to declaring independence. But as to the mood of the populations going back to 2014, the outcome of such a referendum as that being held today was perfectly clear. It is about Russia's ability to use its forces in the territory that it is now assisting in its defense.
Are you surprised? I'm sorry.
Troops into the Russian armed forces.
I'm sorry. Are you surprised that Ukraine hasn't followed through on his promise? Well, this was actually not official news, but there were speculations that would attack the regions that are holding the referendum. Are you surprised that it did not?
Well, they have been attacking them. The reports on Russian television from the polling stations across Donbas show that that many towns have been bombed, that the centers where the balloting is going on have been bombed, and some of the voting is taking place in cellars. So it's not a big matter of restraint. The Ukrainians have done what they could do, which is considerable, but certainly not enough to impede the vote. As we know, in the two republics, Donbas and of the Donbas, the referendums have been called legal since more than 50% of eligible voters took part.
All right. One thing that needs to be cleared up here, because I believe it deserves that, Glenn Deason, is the fact that the war actually began back in 2014, really. But what's important here is to note the stats of what occurred from then on in terms of the shelling by Ukraine, of which, according to Ukraine, which reported at the UN in 2019, 13,000 Ukrainians had been killed and more than 28,000 wounded. And we're looking at the UN Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights reporting in January 2022 that between 2018 and 21, 81.4% of all civilian casualties were caused by active hostilities were in Donetsk and Luhansk. So, you know, this war has been going on for quite some time. A lot of civilian casualties in those regions occurred, in particular those two regions that I mentioned. Isn't that a fact that's overlooked, along with the fact that many of those residents want this referendum to take place?
Yes, and I think that part of the reason why this is often omitted in the media is because it's a narrative which shows NATO's complicity in this. I mean, this is often presented simply as having happened in a vacuum with Russia invading Ukraine in February of this year. But obviously, this conflict did begin in 2014. So it began when Western government supported toppling the President Yanukovych in a coup in 2014. And at this point, you had an uprising in Donbas of people who rejected the new government. And this is when the new government in Kyiv, supported by the United States, launched what it called an anti-terrorist operation against Eastern Ukrainians, which resulted in the deaths of thousands of people. And finally, this result, a peace settlement was reached. The last one was Minsk II agreement in February of 2015, and everyone signed under it. The UN Security Council signed under it in a very clear directions. But since then, we saw that the United States especially, but also Britain to a large extent, worked very hard to undermine this. So they encouraged Kyiv not to sign in, not to implement this, and instead start to pump weapons in to change realities on the ground. And this is part of the reason why also Russia has been not angry, but seeing this as an unsustainable development, because they see that NATO has trained now tens of thousands of troops, armed them to the teeth, and suppressed Russian language, culture, and shut down opposition media, opposition political parties, arrested the political opposition leader. And they saw this as being effectively converting Ukraine into a dagger aimed towards Russia. Now, you can agree or disagree with this analysis, but this is genuinely what Russia sees has happened. So in from December in 2021, they tried to last effort to get a settlement based on the Minsk agreement and get security guarantees from NATO, which they didn't get, and that's when they launched this invasion of Ukraine. Sure. So it is important to get to remember that this did not happen in a vacuum, that this war had been going on for 8 years. And as you correctly pointed out, many people in Donbass do want to join Russia. I mean, even CNN had reports of people wanting to, a lot of Ukrainians standing in lines to get into the Russian-occupied territories. And also 2.5 million Ukrainians fled into Russia. I mean, this is not as black and white as the media would like to have it. Of course, you also on the other side, you see many Ukrainians who used to be very pro-Russian, who's now fiercely anti-Russian because of this conflict. So again, it's not completely black or white.
Indeed. Well, something that our guests there mentioned, Gilbert Doctorow, was about how NATO has trained tens of thousands of soldiers. It makes me think about how in the beginning of this conflict, when it broke out, we noticed how the news, and coming out of Ukraine in particular from Zelensky, that they were in need of people to come and fight. And that was an ongoing rhetoric that we heard from him. But that has died down. What do you attribute to that? There were reports that actually in the UK, the army there was training what was reported 10,000 personnel every month. Are these mercenaries? Are these people who are volunteering? How did Ukraine come up with the numbers?
Well, numbers have been falsified all around, and the Ukrainians are not the only ones. Truth is the first victim of any war. The results that count are not the claims being made in London, but the action on the ground. And the reports that circulate in Western media that the Russians are losing on the ground is ignoring the fact that the territory that they have taken control of and the direction, the vector of their expansion and their successes. Everyone points, of course, to the losses in the Kharkov region, but we all know that that was thinly defended by Russians. It was not a priority area. The great regret they had was the moral defeat that they experienced and the fact that they had to leave behind a good many of the population that supported the Russian integration and who suffered murder and other atrocities after the Russians left. That was a significant blow. However, the Russian strategic position didn't change at all as a result of swift advance by Ukrainian forces in the Kharkov region. But with your permission, I would like to move to the issue that really should be concerning the whole West, and that is the nuclear threats that Mr. Putin is alleged to have made in the last week, how Western leaders have reacted, and what threats are we talking about? In this information war and complete falsification of news that it characterizes major mainstream media, everyone speaks about or Mr. Zelensky is speaking about the nuclear danger that that Mr. Putin is presenting to Ukraine, which is nonsense. The American coastline, the American continent, is the objective of any possible Russian nuclear attack. And Mr. Biden's discussion, or Mr. Blinken's discussion, of how the results of Russia's using nuclear weapons would not be catastrophic are indeed true. The United States will disappear from the map. The Russians have no need or desire to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. With conventional weapons, with the extremely sophisticated missiles that they now possess, hypersonic missiles, they can penetrate any defense systems that the United States may have delivered. They can destroy Kiev tomorrow. The issue is how and when will Russia remove the control and command of the Ukrainian military and put an end to this war? That is within their capability. Attacking the United States, destroying the United States with nuclear weapons is also within their capability at any moment. And that, those are the real issues, not the phony issues of Russians being pressed to the wall and using nuclear weapons to counter Mr. Zelensky's forces. That's rubbish.
Okay, well, to address that question in a form of a question to you, Glenn Deason. What will it take if Russia has the capability to take down Ukraine's army? Why hasn't it done it at this point?
Well, I would argue that it has to some extent. I mean, if you look what has happened to the Ukrainian army and equipment, it's largely been, a lot of it's been destroyed. This last offensive with Soyuz Kharkov, it's mostly with NATO-trained Ukrainian soldiers, with NATO military hardware, with the offensive to a large extent, according to the Americans, directed by them, with guided by American intelligence. So I think a lot of the Ukrainian military infrastructure is gone. But also you have to keep in mind, when Russia entered Ukraine, usually when you invade another country, you need a 3-to-1 ratio. You should have many, three times more soldiers than the one you're invading. However, in this instance, we saw the Ukrainians, they had about 600,000 to 700,000 people that could put, people under arms, and Russia went in with 200,000, plus the people, of course, the local militias from Donbas. Now, with these low numbers, it makes it very difficult. So again, Russia could rely on artillery superiority and not complete dominance of the air, but still supremacy in the air. And it's been very systematically knocking out a lot of the Ukrainian military. But again, it's being trained and refilled at the back end by NATO, which has again almost exhausted a lot of its weapon storage. So it is a war that's being dragged out as long as possible, and that's one of the consequences of NATO supplying weapons. Because you can argue it's a dilemma. You can argue it's a moral argument for giving weapons to someone to defend themselves. But obviously, the argument against is Russia eventually will win this war, and any weapon you send will help to bleed out the Russians, to make them lose money, weapons, and lives. Mm-hmm. But you can drag the war out. But that also applies for Ukraine. By making Ukraine into a new Afghanistan for Russia, you're also completely destroying this country. If I can just make one last point. Initially, if you remember, before 2014, Russia's main objective was to have Ukraine as a neutral country. After the coup, they wanted Donbas to have autonomy within Ukraine, so be a part of Ukraine. And then after that didn't work, after 2022, they recognized the independence of Donbas. And after prolonging the war now they're going to absorb Donbas, Kherson, and Zaporozhye. So this escalation also, as Russia continues to bleed, it also heightened the stakes, and it has a higher return on investment, if you will. So there is the cost of this war, and the stakes keep rising. So, but that doesn't mean that Russia's losing. It just means that the West is also continues to escalate and heighten the stakes.
Gibel Doctorow, you've risen my curiosity as to why you said, let's take this into another context. And you used the whole nuclear factor in this conflict, which I want to ask you why you thought that was so important. Because looking at the exchange of the use of nuclear weapons, you had Jake Sullivan come out saying that it would respond decisively on behalf of the U.S. in terms of how it would respond. But, of course, indirectly he's saying they would respond through the use of nuclear weapons. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has said that we are not going to use weapons unless what they have termed, or what he has termed, Russia would feel an existential threat. So once and for all, if you can, for us, based on your expertise, tell us what scenario would warrant any use of nuclear weapons, or is that just not going to happen?
Ukraine by itself can in no way pose an existential threat to Russia under present circumstances. As the only existential threat can be from NATO. And so, depending on NATO's further escalation steps, it is conceivable that the Russians would be ready to deploy nuclear weapons against NATO and against the United States, not against Ukraine. As I said, with their high-powered conventional missiles, they have no need to open the Pandora's box of tactical nuclear weapons in the Ukraine front. If, however, NATO persists and continues to raise the level of manpower at the Russian borders, which is rising as we talk. NATO and the United States are moving armed men-at-arms closer to the Russian border, ostensibly or arguably to prevent the Russians from making an attack. But it's a totally false argument. They are moving forces to the Russian frontier, again, to threaten Russia and to try to beat Russia into stepping back and stepping down. These increased forces at the Russian border reach a certain critical point, which the Russians alone can judge as being an existential threat, then yes, nuclear weapons against NATO, against Brussels, against Berlin, against Warsaw, and against Washington are entirely thinkable.
Appreciate it, Glenn Deason, Professor of Political Science, University of Southeastern Norway from Oslo. Gilbert Doctorow, thank you so much. Independent International Affairs Analyst from St. Petersburg. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikko Vitale and the team. This is goodbye until next time.
Here at Arabi English Radio, express our heartfelt condolences to all of our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 30th of Safar, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Reza, peace be upon him, the 8th infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. If you have been following this series of shows, we are trying to answer some doubts or misconceptions on the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam or on religious issues in general. Like always, we invite some scholars and researchers from Qom Seminary Schools. This time, again, we have the honor to have Sheikh Nur Muhammad with us in the studio. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. My pleasure to be here.
You're most welcome here. Dear listeners, dear brothers and sisters, the question of the day that we want to ask it from the respected guest speaker is about the quality of giving life and dying. And Shaykhana, the question is that how is it like to die? I mean, at the time that the people are on the verge of dying. Also, is there a difference between the death of a mu'min, the moments of the death of a mu'min, a believer, or an unbeliever? Is there any difference? I mean, is it, for example, let's say, based on what we heard, is easier for the believer and difficult, more difficult for the other one? We'd be thankful if you shed some light on this question.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The issue of death is one of the fundamental issues that many people, they want to discover and to understand and to have some kind of idea about how death is, you know, they face the death and how they can experience this issue. Mm-hmm. I want to say that actually in the verse of Noble Quran, we have plenty of verses talking about the issue of death. For example, we have كل نفس دائقة الموت ثم إلينا ترجعون. Every soul shall taste death, then you brought back to us. In this verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that everybody, every soul, they taste with death.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one day we will taste that. And we have this experience of having, you know, experience of death. But actually, I have to confess that we do not have enough information about that. But because still we did not experience that. But we are approaching one day to experience death.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that we cannot have a lot of explanation. We cannot.
But we
provide.
Have been recommended, Sheikh, mutu qabla an tamutu. We have been said that try to die before you are dead.
You know, this is mutu qabla an tamutu from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. It is another, totally another, you know, separated issue. Because maybe that narration, it is talking about the kind of jihadun nafs, fighting your, you know, whimsical desire.
Mm-hmm.
Actually referring to a spiritual fighting with your passion, with your whimsical desire.
Mm-hmm.
And to have kind of witnessing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and getting close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is a spiritual phase.
Mm-hmm.
But we are talking about the, you know, material one, that, you know, death, that everybody, common death, that everybody is familiar with that. But about the differences between the faithful people and, you know, non-faithful people, we have, for example, وَالنَّازِعَاتِ قَرْقَى, by those angels who rest the soul violently.
Yeah.
You know, referring to the unbeliever. Some angels very violently, they rest the soul of the, you know, some people. So it is very harsh, you know, threatening from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then immediately he said that, وَالنَّاشِطَاتِ nashta, by those who draw it out gently.
Yeah.
You know, referring to the faithful people. Okay, so you can very easily can understand the difference.
Yeah.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sometimes, of course, some angels, by the permission of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, violently they take out the soul of human being. On the other hand, we have sometimes very gently,
mm-hmm,
they receive the soul of human being. So there is a great difference. But one point I have to add here, it is not some physical idea. For example, we see some people by accident, they die very badly. Some people, they have been died. And, you know, we cannot say that individual was unbeliever. No, do not, mm-hmm, you know, take it mistakenly. Rather, it is talking about a spiritual phase. Maybe an unbeliever dies in his bed, very gently, you know, physically speaking, everything is okay.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, behind the curtain, I mean, in the spiritual phase, it has been taken his soul or her soul very violently.
Very true.
Okay? So it is different. I want to say that, do not confuse it with the material scene that we witness.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Can we say that it depends on the kind of our actions and our behavior in this world? So the quality of our death actually is affected by the quality of our actions and treatments in this world, because in case we were righteous people, the kind of death that we have is, let's say, too much easier. Easier in the sense that, I mean, it is very joyful for us to go there. It might be, let's say, in a bad accident, in crashing, I don't know, as you said and you explained. But it is easier because in the hadith, what we understand from